I'd like to welcome everyone to this session. The big fan, Joseph Smith and the Danites in Missouri. We have two great participants in the program today. We really need no introduction, but Todd Compton will be presenting the paper. He's written several books and a lot of articles, notably In Sacred Loneliness, The Plural Wives of Joseph Smith, A Widow's Tale, the 1844 to 1846 Diaries of Helen Mar Kimball, or Whitney, sorry. And he is working on a biography of Jacob Hamblin, so look for that. Responding will be Michael Quinn. He has also written numerous articles and books, including Early Mormonism and the Magic World View, Mormon Hierarchy, Origins of Power, Mormon Hierarchy, Extensions of Power, and the Mormon Hierarchy subtitle, I don't know what, but Volume 3 is going to be coming out perhaps in a year or two. So we'll turn the time over to Todd.
I'm going to read, let's see, how much time do I have? Okay. This session ends in an hour. Okay. I'm going to read an excerpt adapted from the book to be published by Greg Crawford Books, hopefully this year, entitled Fire and Sword, History of the Latter-day Saints in Northern Missouri, 1836 to 39, by Leland H. Gentry and myself. This is Leland Gentry's pioneering 1965 doctoral thesis on the 1838 Mormon War in Missouri, edited and updated by me with Levina Fielding Anderson's editorial help. When I started to work on this project, I decided I would leave Leland's text intact, except for standard stylistic editing and correcting minor mistakes, but add editorial additions to footnotes and an addendum at the end of each chapter, discussing some of the important issues Gentry wrote about and introducing the reader to the progress of research and debate on these issues since 1965. When writers one might consider conservative, such as Alexander Baugh or William Hartley, disagreed with historians one might consider liberal, such as Stephen LeSueur or D. Michael Quinn, I wanted to reflect both sides of the debate. Sometimes I added my point of view, often supported by quotations from primary sources. The following, then, is an excerpt from my addendum on Gentry's chapter on Danites in Mormonism, 1838. So I have to apologize. This will not give you basic information about the 1838 Mormon War, and it even will not give you basic information on what Danites are and a lot of aspects of Danitism, though I will give a small summary about what they are. I should add, sir, that I consider Mike Quinn a moderate historian in many ways, which is how I view myself. Though I see a certain passage in Shirtless autobiography slightly different than he does, I believe his chapter on theocratic ethics and Danitism in his 1994 book, The Mormon Hierarchy, Origins of Power, was path-breaking, and I tend to accept his views on the Danite movement. Speaking more generally, I have been profoundly influenced by his work over the years. The Danites are one of the classic problems in Mormon history. They are the first appearance in Mormon history of what later became popular stereotypes of Mormon secret societies meting out death and violence as ordered by church leaders. They are the prototypes of the destroying angels of Utah, the villains in stories by A. Conan Doyle and Zane Grey. Gentry's treatment here in the chapter of his dissertation was pioneering in its analysis of the history of Danites in Missouri. First, he wasted no energy attempting to argue that Danites did not exist among the Mormons, even though earlier treatments of the Missouri period in Mormon history had sometimes attempted to entirely skirt or deny the existence of Mormon Danites, authorized Mormon Danites. And very early after 1838, Mormons themselves started denying Danitism in Missouri and Joseph Smith's connections with it. Second, since Gentry found the evidence for Dennett's undeniable, he worked out an analysis that explained their existence and occasional excesses among the Mormons. He delineated three developmental periods for the group. One, Dennites were used to intimidate internal dissenters during a few weeks in June 1838. Two, Dennites were a defensive paramilitary force, but not a legal organization, intended to combat mobs from the departure of the dissenters June 19, 1838, through the Mormon War, ending about October 31st, 1838. And three, Dennites were a loose military group that unjustifiably plundered non-Mormons during the Mormon War around October 14th to 31st, 1838. Gentry felt that Joseph Smith did not know about extreme and extra-legal actions taken by the Dennites, the third development, and that Smith subsequently denounced such actions. Research has continued along the lines set out here, although some scholars have disagreed with Gentry on important points, most importantly on how closely Joseph Smith and the First Presidency were involved with the group. And here I list a bunch of bibliography, which I will skip. Okay. So my section in my addendum to Gentry's chapter, this section is called, "To What Extent Was Joseph Smith Connected with the Dennets?" Quote, "Some historians have claimed that Joseph Smith and the rest of the First Presidency were unaware of the Dennett organization, but documentary evidence shows otherwise," end quote, writes Quinn, who included his account of Dennites in a chapter of Mormon Hierarchy titled Theocratic Beginnings. The head of the Dennets was a man named Sampson Abbard, and he eventually turned against Joseph Smith in the church and testified against him. And pretty much everyone agrees that he is not totally trustworthy. And so his testimony is kind of tainted, but you have to look at it carefully. Some things look like they're reliable, other things don't. Abbard's testimony certainly implicated Joseph Smith and Dennett activities, but his testimony is tainted because everyone, Mormon and anti-Mormon, agrees he was not entirely trustworthy. It is necessary to examine evidence outside of Abbard to gauge Smith's involvement in the group. Most scholars have accepted that Joseph Smith attended day-night meetings in Far West and Adam-on-Diama. Alexander Baugh agrees that the First Presidency probably attended Far West day-night meetings in June or early July and participated actively and supportively in it. Baugh quotes the testimony of the usually trustworthy John Corll. Quote, "I was afterwards invited to one of these meetings where an oath in substance the same as testified to by Dr. Abbard was administered. The society was ultimately organized into companies and captains of tens and fifties were appointed. At the second, or at least the last meeting I attended, the presidency, to wit Joseph Smith Jr., Hiram Smith, and Sidney Rigdon, and also George W. Robinson, was there. There was at this meeting a ceremony of introducing the officers of the society to the presidency, who pronounced blessings on each of them as introduced, exhorting to faithfulness in their calling, and they should have blessings. After this, President Smith got up and made general remarks about, in substance, as follows, relating the oppressions the society had suffered, and they wanted to be prepared for further events, but said he wished to do nothing unlawful, and if the people would let him alone, they would preach the gospel and live in peace. Towards the close, he observed to the people that they should obey the presidency, and if the presidency led them astray, they might destroy them." End quote. You can, I'm sorry there weren't enough handouts to go around, but on those who have handouts, a lot of these quotes are on these handouts. You can follow. This is convincing firsthand anecdotal evidence. Baugh also cites Reed Peck's testimony, who said, quote, "I was present at one meeting when the officers of the society were present and were introduced to the First Presidency, each officer receiving a blessing from them." Abbard stated that he had procured the presidency to come there to show the society that what he had been doing was according to their direction or will. And while there, the presidency approved of Abbard's course in the society, end quote. However, Peck then continues, "Dr. Abbard, however, did not explain to the presidency what his teaching had been in the society," end quote. This last statement from an fairly antagonistic source would support Gentry's thesis that Joseph Smith did not know all of Edwards' teachings. However, Joseph Smith attending the meeting and blessing the Danite officers would show that he approved of the organization and knew a great deal about it. John Coral testified that he felt that the first presence had guided Samson Avery. It was my understanding that Dr. Avery's teaching in the Danite Society proceeded from the presidency. Coral also wrote, Arbord was very forward and indefatigable in accomplishing their purposes, for he devoted his whole talents to it and spared no pains. And I thought was as grand a villain as his wit and ability would admit of. And Coral, by the way, he left the church also, so he isn't a conservative Mormon writing here. And he calls him as grand a villain as his wit and ability would admit of. How much he was assisted by the presidency, I know not, but I thought that they stood as wire workers behind the curtain. Be this as it may, they ran into awful extremes, for it seemed that they felt justified and thought it was the will of God to use any measures whatever, whether lawful or unlawful, to accomplish their purpose and put down those that opposed them. But here let me remark that this was known only to some half dozen or so of the leaders, and not to the church, not even the great majority of this secret society. I accused Smith and Rigdon of it, but they both denied it promptly. Be that as it may, it was clearly evident to me that the leaders of this faction intended to set up a monarchical government in which the presidency should tyrannize and rule over all things. It's a really interesting statement if you look at that. He goes back and forth about whether Joseph Smith was really involved and how much he was involved. Alexander Baugh, citing Schwartzel, also accepts that Joseph Smith attended Danite meetings at least twice in Adam Ondayon on July 14th and 21st. According to Schwartzel, Joseph Smith preached at these meetings, all of which would be totally in line with the other quotes we've seen. All of the First Presidency, Joseph Smith, Rigdon, and Hiram Smith, preached at the July 14th meeting and in the July 21st meeting, and Joseph Smith preached for some time. So he was not merely a passive attendant. He was actively supporting the Danite cause. Though Schwartzel was disaffected, it is impossible to reject the idea of Danite meetings in Adam Ondayon, because reference to meetings of the Danites and the Daughters of Zion appear in the diaries of conservative member John Smith. Baugh also notes that Joseph Smith / George W. Robinson in the Scriptory book on July 27, 1838, spoke approvingly of the Danites. And this is a book that is in, George Robinson was the scribe, and there's a lot of Joseph Smith's content in it. It's published in Jesse's Papers of Joseph Smith. And on that date it was written, we have a company of Danites in these times to put to right physically that which is not right, and to cleanse the church of very great evils, which hath hitherto existed among us, inasmuch as they cannot be put to right by teachings and persuasions. This company, or a part of them, exhibited on the fourth day of July. They come up to consecrate by companies of tens, commanded by their captain over ten. End quote. According to Baugh, Smith participated in the Davies expedition in early August, the expedition to DeWitt, and the Mormon offensive in Davies County in October, each of which included Mormon and Danite members. End quote. D. Michael Quinn has argued that Joseph Smith was formally initiated as a Danite, citing the autobiography of faithful Mormon Lumen Shurtleff. Since Averd testified that he did not know if Joseph Smith was formally initiated, Quinn argues that Smith probably was, in fact, initiated in Adam Ondayon. In view of the importance of this issue, I will look at the Shurtleff autobiography carefully. After mentioning the election battle at Gallatin, which occurred on August 6, 1838, Shurtleff wrote, about this time I received an invitation to unite with a society called the Danite Society, and to meet with them at their next meeting, which I did, and found it was got up for our personal defense, also of our families, property, and our religion. Signs and passwords given by which each member could know the other wherever they met, night or day. Each person to settle all difficulty, if he had any, with a member of the society before he could be received. I considered this a good institution for the benefit of society and a blessing for this people, but it broke out on our leaving the state of Missouri. I hope I've convinced you by this time that conservative Mormons were involved in Danite. In Daniteism. Okay, Shurtleff wrote that in October, he marched from far west with the expedition that went to Davies County and camped in a grove near Colonel White's home. During the expedition, he was stationed at a tree to prevent spies or enemies from entering Adirondack from the north. Quote, under this tree I was stationed one night with orders to let no person pass except he gave the countersign. About 9 o'clock, I heard two men coming from toward camp. I knew by their voices it was our prophet and his brother Hiram. When they came in hailing distance, I hailed them, inquired who they were. The answer was friends. I bade them advance and give the countersign, which they did over the muzzle of my rifle in true military style. I add the next paragraph, a humorous incident, because it also shows the importance of the password. I'll summarize a little bit of this. He hears a sound coming up the path and challenges whoever or whatever is coming. Expecting every instant to see the flash of some person's rifle, but the sound began to move toward me when in a tone of authority I ordered it to halt when the animal turned its head out of the road as if to say, I am a cat. I stepped out of the road and let her pass without giving the countersign. Thus giving the cow more lenity than I did the prophet of God. That's a humorous incident, but it shows how seriously he took this, this business he was involved in. My initial question, we're in the quote here, on reading this text was this a Danite sign and countersign, or a military sign and countersign limited to this particular camp? A standard exchange of challenge, password, and countersign has been described. It's common throughout military history, but it's been described in this particular history of the American Revolution. And you have an excerpt from this quote. And I'll summarize some of this. The writer describes what a military camp was like. And in the distant border of the camp, before the 9 o'clock tattoo is beaten, the fife and the drum that announces the hour for giving the countersign and password of the night from the colonel's quarters. There's a particular countersign and password for each evening, each day. More poetic description of the camp. The sentries and guards, the dull tramp of the sentries and guards upon measuring their lonely beats in every direction, the tents like rows of great liners set in a broad even field, or later in the night, the halt that wakes echoes in this slumbering enchantment and is followed by that formal dialogue. Who comes there? A friend. Friend, advance and give the countersign. While you know that during the parley, life or death to be challenged hangs upon the finger of the faithful guard, who holds his bayoneted rifle to the heart of a fellow bee until he proves him to be a friend. That gave me insight on what Shurtleff meant when he said, gave the countersign, which they did over the muzzle of my rifle. Evidently, the rifle was brought right close to the person being challenged. In other words, who comes there and a friend or customary military language for a sentry examination? The password is given by the sentry or person approaching, and the countersign answers it, as the name implies. The password and the countersign change every day, being given out by the colonel at a specific time every day. Shurtleff was acting as a sentry here, so he is acting in the classic situation for standard military challenge, password, and countersign. As I tried to answer my original question, was Joseph Smith participating in a Danite exchange, I had to take into account the fact that Danites were a military organization. And I'm not going to read the quotes at the end of your handout, but there's a little section on military aspects of Danitism and whether, you know, Danitism was a really narrow oath-bound group, or whether all the Mormon soldiers were, almost all the Mormon soldiers were Danites. Okay, I hadn't taken into account the fact that Danites were a military organization, so this countersign could be a standard military countersign and a Danite password. And I believe this is entirely possible. But I think the possibility that, Smith and Shurtleff were using a simple military countersign limited to this particular camp that changed daily should be examined also. Later in the autobiography, Shurtleff does describe his company using a limited non-Danite password countersign when they were on an expedition at night. Quote, "We then made a countersign for the benefit of our company in case we should, in the dark, get separated," end quote. When a group of Mormons arrived who did not have the company countersign, Shurtleff was sent to meet them because he could exchange Danite passwords and countersigns with them. Quote, "I volunteered to go as a guard north, knowing we were Danites and would know each other in the dark as well as light. Accordingly, I told the company to prepare the family and goods, and I would go north and receive the teams if one of the brethren would go with me." Brother John Taylor, since one of the 12 and one of the presidents of our church, said he would go with me. However, while they rode together, Shurtleff writes, quote, "I learned that Brother Taylor was not a Danite. My oath was such that I did not feel at liberty to use any sign or password under such circumstances," end quote. This passage, incidentally, shows how seriously Mormons took Danitism and the Danite oath. Thus, the Shurtleff autobiography shows that limited military non-Danite passwords were used during the 1838 Mormon War. However, it is possible that Shurtleff's company used the limited company passwords because they were a company separated from the main force of Mormons, roaming in the dark. Standard Danite passwords were possibly used in military camps near Annamon. But I believe Shurtleff just left the door open that the countersign that Joseph Smith and Hiram gave him over the muzzle of his rifle, quote, "in true military style," end quote, was a military countersign changed nightly, limited to a particular camp. I think there's a good chance that it may have been a Danite sign and password, but believe that a reader in good faith might also interpret it as a limited camp countersign. If Joseph Smith was not formally initiated as a Danite, perhaps he felt that the Danite movement was something that he had oversight over and approved of, as we've seen, but did not need to be technically part of. It was a movement that supported the First Presidency, and that the First Presidency supported, but the First Presidency perhaps did not feel a need to be technically part of it. But this is not certain, and the evidence from the Shurtleff autobiography remains ambiguous in my view. Aside from the issue of Joseph Smith's use of passwords, the Shurtleff reminiscence certainly shows the importance of Danite signs and passwords and shows they were used during the war. Whatever Smith's involvement with the Danites, and he certainly attended Danite meetings and spoke at them, Quinn has emphasized that Joseph clearly had no way of knowing all the excesses that Mormon Danites and extremists may have committed in their plunderings of non-Mormons in Davies County. As Quinn emphasized in an oral presentation at the John Whitmer Historical Association meeting in September 2003, no commander-in-chief entirely understands or controls all that happens in the fog of war. Historian William G. Hartley of Brigham Young University wrote, quote, "There's no question that the Latter-day Saint Rangers burned buildings at Millport and Gallatin, and Oliver Huntington's view of non-Mormon and Mormon sorties both seem to be mutually agreed to rob and plunder all they could." Hartley suggests that such actions, illegal in peacetime, served justifiable strategic purposes in wartime. And the full story of that, you'll have to read the chapter in the forthcoming book. As noted earlier in this chapter, descriptions of Danite signs and countersigns often employed Masonic terminology. The Masonic idea was that a Mason in danger would make a Masonic sign or speak a Masonic word or phrase. Then fellow Masons would recognize this signal and come to his aid. The Danite signs and passwords served exactly the same functions and were used in this way during the election knockdown at Gallatin that kind of started the Mormon War in 1838. For the complex story of Joseph Smith's involvement with Masonry, see Michael W. Homer's Similarity of Priesthood and Masonry, the relationship between Freemasonry and Mormonism. Given Smith's extensive interest in Masonry at Nauvoo, it is possible that Masonic aspects of Danitism are a pre-Nauvoo example of Smith's interest in the Masonic ritual. And it should be remembered that Lucinda Pendleton Morgan Harris, wife of George W. Harris, a prominent member of the Far West High Council, was a widow of Masonic martyr William Morgan, who had published the first expose of the Masonic rite. The Joseph Smith family stayed with the Harrises when they first arrived in Far West. Thank you.
I think that you could give another 5 or 10 minutes of your paper if you want. We still have time. Why don't you do that?
Okay.
I'm usually so worried about going over. There's a couple other sections here. That are relevant. Okay? Joseph Smith as a military figure in Missouri. Which is another section of my opinion. Scholars have thus debated the extent to which Joseph Smith Jr. was involved with the Danites. A related question is, to what extent was Joseph Smith involved in the Saints' armies in Missouri? Some see him as the commander-in-chief of the armies of Israel. Others see him as separated from overt military actions. Once again, this modern scholarly divide can be traced back to contradictory testimony in the primary sources. Gentry quotes George Hinkle, subsequently left the church, as stating that, quote, the presidency was to have supreme rule, end quote, with their headquarters in Annemarie. However, Gentry discounts this statement, arguing that Hinkle was disgruntled because he felt he had been wronged by Joseph Smith. Gentry regards two other statements as more reliable. The first is by non-Mormon resident of the Far West, John Clemenson, who stated that, quote, it was not usual for any of the presidency to take up arms and go into the ranks, end quote. However, military commanders, such as generals, usually do not take up weapons or physically fight in the ranks. So Joseph Smith still could have been a commander-in-chief of some sort. The second document is by Joseph Smith himself and loyalists Alanson Ripley, Heber C. Kimball, William Huntington, and Joseph B. Noble, who, in a petition, stated that Smith, quote, never commanded any military company nor held any military authority, that he never has borne arms in the military rank, end quote. Quinn, in contrast, sees Smith as the commander and driving force for Mormon militancy, noting that the Danite Constitution states, all officers shall be subject to the commands of the Captain General given through the Secretary of War. Quinn argues that Quinn held the position of Secretary of War in the Church War Department for 3 years and had been Commander-in-Chief of the Armies of Israel since 1835. John Whitmer wrote, quote, and it came to pass on the 24th day of September 1835, on which day we met in the course of the house of Joseph Smith, Jr., the seer, where we, according to a previous commandment given, appointed David Whitmer, Captain of the Lord's Host, and President F.G. Williams and Sidney Rigdon as his assistants, and President W.W. Phelps, myself, and John Coral as an assistant corps, and Joseph Smith, Jr., the seer, to stand at the head and be assisted by Hiram Smith and Oliver Kent. This much for the War Department by revelation. The history of the church for September 24, 1835 corroborates, quote, Joseph Smith, Jr. was nominated to be the commander-in-chief of the armies of Israel, end quote. This meeting occurred 3 years before the 1838 war, but it does show that Joseph Smith had a hands-on attitude toward military matters in the church. Benjamin Johnson wrote that in Missouri and Nauvoo, Benjamin Johnson, a very loyal Mormon, he wrote, the Prophet Joseph laid the foundation of our church in military spirit, underlined, and as the master taught his disciples, so he taught us to sell our coats and buy swords. On October 28, 1838, Albert Perry Rockwood, another faithful church member, wrote to his father, now, Father, come to Zion and fight for the religion of Jesus. The prophet goes out to battle as in days of old. He has the sword that Nephi took from Laban. Is not this marvelous? The prophet has unsheathed his sword and in the name of Jesus declares that it shall not be sheathed again until he can go unto any county or state in safety and in peace. Solomon Wixom remembered Joseph Smith actually lifting a sword during a dramatic speech after the raid in Davies County. And he remembers Smith proclaiming, I have drawn my sword from its sheath, and I swear by the living God that it shall never return again till I can come and go and be treated by others as they wish to be treated by me. End quote. And so those quotes seem to show Joseph Smith very much involved in the militarism in the 1838 war, which is closely connected with Danaism. Thanks.
Second thanks.
Todd Compton has given a cautious analysis of two controversies in early Mormonism. First, the evidence for an oath-bound group of Mormons called the Society of Dan, who were allegedly authorized by the Latter-day Saint hierarchy in mid-1838 to intimidate and, if necessary, use violence against those perceived as enemies to the LDS Church and its living prophet, Joseph Smith Jr. Second, the evidence for Smith's own knowledge, participation, and direction of these Danites from June through October 1838, during which time their hands-on leader was known to be General Samson Avard, a loyal Mormon at that time. I'll begin by acknowledging the persuasiveness of Compton's challenge to my published interpretation of Lumen Shirtliff's autobiography. He sees it as more likely that Sentry Shirtliff gave the temporary military password, military sign, and military countersign to Joseph Smith and Hiram Smith on the night the autobiography described. If the prophet Joseph was not a Danite, he would not have been able to return the Danite countersign of recognition in the darkness. I acknowledge that this military-only exchange of passwords and signs was a possibility, and I should have done so explicitly in the text of my 1994 Origins of Power. Nonetheless, as stated there, I am persuaded that Joseph Smith's crucial connections with the Danites make it far more likely that Shirtliff was offering him the Danite password and sign, which the sentry declined to do with recently appointed Apostle John Taylor, who was not a Danite. Compton's paper does not present various items of evidence that are crucial to understanding the entire First Presidency's close ties with the Danite Band in 1838 and their official direction and monitoring of its activities. These details are crucial for assessing Joseph Smith's knowledge and authorization. Concerning his first counselor, Sidney Rigdon, Samson Avard specified that Rigdon wrote the text of the Danites' death threat on 18 June 1838 against Far West's prominent dissenters. This included Book of Mormon witnesses Oliver Cowdery, David Whitmer, and John Whitmer. Although Avard was a turncoat when he said this, Ebenezer Robinson remained loyal to Joseph Smith and later corroborated Avard's testimony. In his own autobiography, Robinson wrote that he was a Danite and that this threatening ultimatum, quote, was gotten up in the office of the First Presidency, unquote. Edited by Apostle John Taylor, the Nauvoo Neighbor would eventually publish Apostle Orson Hyde's statement that Rigdon told him at Far West that it, quote, was the imperative duty of the church to obey the word of Joseph Smith or the presidency without question or inquiry, and if there were any that would not, they should have their throats cut from ear to ear, unquote. This disclosure of Rigdon's 1838 sentiments were no surprise to Nauvoo's Mormons because the first counselor had already instructed a general conference there, quote, there are men standing in your midst that you can't do anything with them but cut their throat and bury them, unquote. The prophet said nothing in dissent from his first counselor's remarks. Benjamin Slade, a lifelong Mormon, also testified in 1839 that Rigdon had boasted about such throat slitting in 1838. Quote, yesterday a man had slipped his wind and was thrown into the bush, Rigdon told a closed-door meeting of Mormon men, apparently Danites, and added, quote, the man that lisps it shall die, unquote. Moreover, Joseph Smith had no objections to such extra-legal punishment. 5 years later, he warned the Mormons during General Conference, quote, I'll wring a thief's neck off if I can find him, if I cannot bring him to justice any other way, unquote. When Danite John L. Butler heard his prophet preach on that occasion in Nauvoo, He understood him to say that, quote, the time would come that the sinners would have their heads cut off to save them, unquote. Butler said that the, quote, Spirit of God filled him, unquote, as he listened to those words. His account was included in the LDS Church's official journal history for 6 August 1838, the Battle of a Danite group with Missourians that started the Civil War. Although concerning the above, also concerning the above, Compton's paper quotes a phrase from Joseph Smith's journal called the Scriptory Book in July 1838. It shows the prophet's knowledge that the Danites were supposed to use force against LDS dissidents. Quote, we have a company of Danites in these times to put to right physically that which is not right, and to cleanse the church of very great evils, unquote. Since an apostle and a rank and file believer heard Rigdon specify in June 1838 that throat slitting was the remedy for disloyal Mormons, I find it impossible to regard the LDS president as unaware of his first counselor's repeated instructions, especially since Rigdon boasted to a meeting that such in Missouri that such killing had already occurred and would be inflicted on disloyal Mormons in future. The most prominent dissenters later wrote that they had escaped such a death sentence only by fleeing immediately for their lives from Far West. David Whitmer and John Whitmer both wrote that. Concerning second counselor Hiram Smith and assistant counselor John Smith, who had been publicly sustained in 1837 to those positions within the first presidency, Samson Avard was the first signer of the written death threat in mid-June 1838, after which Hiram Smith and Uncle John Smith joined in signing with 80 other men. Robinson, who signed it, later wrote that all the signers were members of the recently organized military organization of Danites. And Compton notes that John Smith often mentioned Danite activities in his own diary as a member of the First Presidency, but also as a stake president in Adamon Dionys. Because his brother and uncle were serving the First Presidency as initiated Danites, and because Counselor Rigdon wrote the Danite death threat, I find it impossible to regard Joseph Smith as a mere visitor or mere speaker at the Danite meetings he attended, according to the several witnesses whom Compton acknowledges. Shurtleff's autobiography shows that he gave a special password and sign to the LDS president and his brother Hiram, a verified Danite, on one night in the summer of 1838. All contextual evidence supports my conclusion that this was a rank-and-file Danite, proudly giving a Danite signal to the LDS Church's most prominent Danites. Shurtleff's autobiography subsequently showed that he was eager to give Danite signals to other Danites while on guard duty. In isolation, his faithfully Mormon Danite reminiscence proves nothing about the two members of the First Presidency he greeted in the dark. In conjunction with other evidences about the Danite roles of Counselor Sidney, Hiram, and Uncle John, Shurtleff's autobiography is, in my view, final proof of Joseph Smith Jr.'s formal affiliation and membership in the 1838 Society of Dan. Todd Compton allows this only as, quote, a good chance that it may have been a Danite sign and password, unquote. So we remain in only partial agreement. That is often how it is among historians. Thank you.
Thanks.
Todd, I don't know if you want to respond to Mike.
Yes, please.
Yeah, I think I'm 99.9% in agreement with Mike. I see a little more ambiguity than he does in this one particular text. But otherwise, I don't see much difference between us. He talked about the letter that was written to warn the dissenters out of Far West, and these were very prominent high members of the church, like Oliver Cowdery, David Whitmer. And we talked about 80 people signed it. and they warned the dissenters to leave far west. If not, a fatal commanded, quote, a fatal calamity shall befall you. Those are very strong words. What strikes me as very odd about that is Hiram Smith signs it, John Smith signs it, Joseph Smith does not sign it. It's like he's kind of putting a little bit of distance between himself and that letter. Himself and total, you know, participation in this Danite activity. But I think he was involved in sending the letter out, possibly involved in writing it, and so on. So that's, in a nutshell, that's my response to his response.
I'd be really interested in a response from both of you about what this particular episode, well, I guess up to the end of October, what this shows us about Joseph Smith. Because he'd certainly left Kirtland under a cloud, and it wouldn't be possible to argue that he was at the top of his game there. But he seems to have taken, at least from my perspective, action that was hasty, in some cases reckless, guaranteed to irritate the Missouri neighbors, guaranteed to split the church and alienate people who've been his supporters. Am I just seeing this too black and white? What was going on inside the mind of Joseph Smith?
Lavanya is a very hands-on co-editor. Why don't you answer that question first yourself? Obviously, Joseph Smith was a very complex individual, and his involvement in Missouri is a complex question. Richard Bushman, when his book came out, I was very interested to see how he would deal with Joseph Smith in the 1838 war. He kind of portrays Joseph Smith as uncharacteristically passive during that 1838 period. And as I point out in my book, that kind of contradicts what some of the leading authorities on the 1838 Mormon War think of his involvement, of Steve LeSueur and Gentry himself. They both believe that he was very energetic, and that the things that happened in Missouri often were as a result of him and Sidney Rigdon coming to Missouri. And so I've encouraged Richard Bushman to write more on Joseph Smith in Missouri. I think he was more energetic than has been portrayed by Bushman and other people. It's interesting. Some of the most inflammatory things were done and said by Sidney Rigdon, not by Joseph Smith. However, there's evidence that Joseph Smith supported Sidney Rigdon. But it's interesting, it's like he's keeping a step away from the most inflammatory things. But in... when did Sidney Rigdon give that inflammatory... Was that the July 4th?
July 4th
speech that was inflammatory and helped, you know, cause a lot of bad will among non-Mormons in Missouri. And Sidney Rigdon gave the speech, but Joseph Smith had it published and distributed. But Sidney Rigdon gave the speech.
Sidney always gave the speech.
Pardon?
Sidney was the orator.
That's right. And we could look at the personality there. You know, the personality, the characters of Joseph and Sidney as they worked together. Clearly that's what was happening. But on the other hand, you see that Sidney Rigdon was giving a lot of the inflammatory things, but Joseph Smith was supporting him.
Do we know if Joseph was in attendance at Sidney's speech?
Off the top of my head, he probably was, but off the top of my head, I don't remember. Yeah. He probably was.
It was a big procession.
Yeah. Mike?
to the question of what was Joseph thinking, I don't know if this is in Richard Bushman's Rough Stone Rolling, but I think there's an apt comparison and contrast between Joseph Smith and Brigham Young in this regard. And you could compare them with respect to the Utah War of 1858 and 20 years earlier to the Mormon War in Utah in 1838. Joseph Smith acted spontaneously, and Brigham Young acted with calculation. And I think that distinguished them throughout their lives. Brigham Young was very shrewd. He was very calculating about consequences of what he did and did not do. Joseph Smith was not. He just acted. And I think another dimension about what he's thinking, but this is mind reading because I don't have any source for this, but I think in terms of particularly what this one member of the church was saying, where I've unsheathed my sword, quoting Joseph Smith, and saying that I will not sheath it again until I can go to any county or any state without being troubled. I think that Joseph Smith misperceived the significance of the creation of the county of Caldwell, Ohio, Caldwell, Missouri, as a Mormon county. The state of Missouri did this. The legislature did it. It's quite a remarkable thing that a county was created for a religious group. And I think that somehow Joseph in his own mind thought of it in advance, in some ways, like Nauvoo became a legally established entity of its own. And I think that Joseph Smith felt that had given him the right to do and assert the kinds of things that he was doing because he and the people of that county had extra rights that were not given to other people of the state. That was clearly not the intent of the legislature, and yet I think that he felt that he would not allow any kind of resistance to the rights as he perceived them of the Mormons, and therefore he said and did the kinds of things he did in June, July, and August of 1838.
Okay, this is an issue that I'm really interested in, but more so because I'm interested in why people are so interested in this issue. And here's the reason why. So I recently finished a film on the 1838 war, and that's one of the questions that came up while interviewing various scholars, Lesweer, Baugh, Bushman, all included, was this question of Joseph's involvement with the Danites. And it was interesting to see how, depending on who I was talking to, they all seemed to take a pretty real sort of strong stance on one side or the other, even though they all shared the same facts. What struck me as strange was that it seemed to me that the Danites were only doing things that Joseph would have wanted done anyways. When he got up there, the first thing he wanted done was he wanted the dissenters out. You know, he was fiercely determined to not allow what happened to Curtin allow here. And the Danites took care of that, you know, whether he told them to do it or not. I can't imagine he'd be too upset that they were gone. Then the expedition into Davies County, partially, if not fully, instigated by Joseph, at least Joseph and Sidney. Again, they wanted that message sent. It was sent. And you know, many other instances you could point out where I don't think they're going necessarily against Joseph Smith's agenda in Missouri, whether you like the agenda or not. And so my question is, regardless of the answer, why should Latter-day Saints be, mortified to find out that Joseph were a Danite or participated? Why should it be such a hot button issue? Because I know, from an outsider's point of view, you hear about a secret society and all these words that sound really exciting and controversial. But I think when you look at it, my question is, why wouldn't he? But if he is, why Are we that surprised, or why should we care?
Very early on, Mormons started denying both Danaitism and Joseph Smith's involvement in Danaitism. And I think partially because the Danites did go into excesses at times in the raid in Davies County. And in the raid in Davies County, the Mormons sometimes sacked non-Mormon homes and did some of the things that we Mormons typically think of anti-Mormon mobs doing to us. And Quinn, as I quoted, he said, no commander-in-chief knows everything that goes on in the following war. You know, but still, it was, you know, the excesses of the Danites and some of their doctrine that could be interpreted as treasonous made it so that Mormons later wanted to deny Danitism, deny Joseph Smith's involvement in Danitism. And with a lot of primary documents coming out, we found that we cannot deny loyal Mormons being involved in Danitism. And I believe the documents really show that we cannot deny Joseph Smith's involvement in Danitism. And so, beginning with Gentry, we've started to try to work out a way to explain these things. But sometimes it's not easy for, you know, very conservative Mormons.
I think there are two reasons for the interest. First, sex and violence, just, you know, everyone's ears perk up. No matter what the context, no matter who's involved, whether it's the French Terror, even that title, the French Terror, people say, what's that? I want to know about it. It's somehow appealing to the human
prurient interest.
Mind or curiosity. The other thing is that we should not underestimate the lack of awareness of Mormons generally about any of these issues. My mother, for example, was a sixth generation Mormon, but I remember just in passing telling her once that Joseph Smith tried to become president of the United States, and she laughed and flatly denied it. That's ridiculous. Where did you get that idea? So the idea that for many members of the church, many of these issues simply are unknown. And they're unknown for a good reason, because they have not been, even in a mild form, taught in the seminary programs of the church, the Sunday schools that teach church history, even the institutes pussyfoot around them. And so that because there's this, it's kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy. The leadership of the church has wanted to back away from any possibility of controversy and therefore don't discuss it in the lesson plans that are approved for the members of the church, and then are surprised when members of the church are shocked, disheartened, and disaffected when they learn about these controversies, that if there had been some kind of introduction, they wouldn't be shocked by it. But my mother managed to live into her 70s and didn't know, as a sixth-generation Mormon, that Joseph Smith tried to become president of the United States.
Yeah, my favorite example of that kind of thing is Juanita Brooks growing up. And here's the granddaughter of Dudley Lovett. And growing up right in the heart of southern Utah, southern Nevada. And growing up believing and being taught that the Mountain Meadows Massacre was an Indian massacre.
This is arrogant on my part, but it's kind of a comment on Levina's earlier question. Why did Joseph Smith suddenly resort to these incredible things? And I'm going to quote Mike Quinn from the 2003 John Whitmer History Association Convention, when the same question was asked. And if I remember your answer correctly, Mike, you said Joseph had his back against the wall. Everything had gone to hell in a handbasket in Kirtland, and now it looked like they were going from the frying pan into the fire in Missouri, and he was desperate. So that's just an arrogant comment on my part. Question, Todd, your book, in what ways is this going to differ from Lesueur's book? What new things are you presenting? What different interpretations are you providing, et cetera?
It's Lesueur, by the way.
The square.
Yeah, runs from here.
My apologies.
I didn't know. As I said, this is basically Gentry's book. And however, at the end of every chapter, I've added addenda, and I've tried to trace, you know, the arguments and the controversies since Gentry was published, and tried to outline them. And occasionally, you know, I've thrown my own ideas in. Occasionally, I've done some research of my own on certain issues. And so it will, you know, it will have...
Todd's being too modest. He did a ton of research.
Actually, Levina really helped me with a lot of, with developing some ideas that appeared in the book. But it brings the whole argument up to date since 1865. And the Lesueur's book I like, but my book will also reflect a lot of the conservative authors. Alexander Baugh often takes issue with Lesueur, and I quote Alexander Baugh a lot in the book. That's just one example.
A more basic question, but I do want to just give my opinion. I hope Joseph Smith was involved.
It makes a good play, a good script.
I just want to know, I've always wondered if there's any interaction between the Council of the 50 and the Day Knights, and if you could just kind of illuminate this on if they were totally separate or if there was some kind of interaction.
The Danites as an organization ceased to exist in November 1838, but Danites, of course, knew one another. Those who did not leave the church remained with the church. They recognized one another, and they had these signs and countersigns of brotherhood that they saw themselves as lifelong. So the last Danite to die would be when the last remnant of the Danite organization ended, but as a functioning organization, it ended in November 1838. The Council of 50 had a totally separate origin. It originated through Revelation. Joseph Smith, an unpublished one, received in April 1842. He didn't organize it until March 1844, and included among the members of the Council of 50 were former Danites. So you had an overlapping of secret organizations, secret oaths, and yet they're different oaths. The Danite oaths were different from Masonic oaths because it wouldn't be no protection against a Masonic anti-Mormon if the Danite oaths were just a Masonic oath. They had to be something that no one else knew but other Danites. And then likewise, the oaths that they took as members of the Council of 50 still another set. So you have people in multiple roles over time. The police force that was formed in Nauvoo, for example, was almost exclusively Danite. And it was headed, commanded by a Danite officer from Missouri. So you have these linkages that continue, and that you could say, well, there's a continuation of the Danite society in a way, but as a functioning organization set up according to the Constitution that Avard eventually revealed, it ceased to operate in November 1838.
Last question. The Mormons, like the Jews, have become masters of playing the victim card. And in the problems that took place in Missouri, the church tries to portray itself as a victim. And yet I suspect, as in most wars, it was just two groups of bullies going after each other and starting violence on both sides. Was there one side, the Missourians or the Mormons, that were more culpable in the Missouri problems, or was it just two groups going at each other, two groups of bullies?
I think, you know, there were mistakes, excesses that the Mormons committed, but I believe they were, you know, they were more the victims in this war. And I think the war was just massively unjust. You know, to force a group of people to leave the state. The Ponce Mill Massacre, the Mormons really were not responsible for that. You can look into the reasons for the Ponce Mill Massacre, why the non-Mormons felt it was necessary, but it was still a horrible, horrible crime. But we should never forget that the Mormons themselves committed excesses. And it's like tragedies. One bad thing happens, another thing builds on it, and it ends up in horrible violence. But I think the Mormons were more the victims. But we shouldn't forget that often, sometimes the non-Mormons were the victims.
Michael, do you agree with that?
Yes.
Okay.
I'd like to remind everyone that you can purchase an audio of this at the desk, and books by both Mike and Todd are available down the hall for purchase. And let's give them a round of applause.